Hello there, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you listen on. Now let me flag up once again the exciting recent addition to our membership system. From now on, included in the Turkey Book Talk membership deal is the archive of a whopping 231 reviews that I wrote for Hürriyet Daily News until this summer. Those reviews sadly appear to have been deleted by HDN, but rather than let all that labour just disappear, I've decided to give Turkey Book Talk members access to the archive of all those reviews that I wrote over the course of 5 years. They cover a pretty diverse spread of subjects, from Turkish and international fiction and poetry to history, journalism, politics, the Middle East and Europe. Members get all the reviews packaged up and put into various categories, so the archive should be pretty easy to browse. If you sign up as a member, you'll receive that archive along with all the other extras that a Turkey Book Talk membership brings. That includes full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk via email as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which so far amounts to over 70 conversations and well over 200,000 words. And that archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Finally, members also get access to a very nice 30% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast so far, including in the current episode actually, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. To become a member and help us keep going, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find a link to at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, or of course by doing a Google search. As we post new episodes every 2 weeks, the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome, but so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want, and if you're not sure about it for yourself, why not consider just signing up for a friend or colleague who may be interested. But now let's get going with our latest episode, in which we speak to Avadis Hajian. He's the author of Secret Nation, The Hidden Armenians of Turkey, which was published earlier this year by IB Taurus. Back in 2004, the late journalist Hrant Dink suggested that there could be up to 2 million people in today's Turkey who descend from Armenians who survived the 1915 massacres by hiding, escaping, or converting to Islam. That same year, Turkish lawyer Fethiye Çetin caused a stir with her own book, My Grandmother, which describes the surprise discovery of her own Armenian ancestors. Now, in Secret Nation, journalist Avadis Hajian describes an intrepid journey across eastern Turkey, recording hundreds of stories of survival, discovery, denial, and acceptance in the towns and villages once densely populated by Armenians. It's a sensitive, sophisticated and intense book, and I started by asking Hajian when exactly he carried out the research for it, as well as how he overcame the language barriers in multilingual eastern Anatolia.
Well, I first traveled to Turkey in 2011, and then I went back in 2013 and 14, which was the longest stretches of time I was there. As for the dialects, I can be conversant in Homshetsnak. I could understand with some difficulty the Sassoon dialect when I had to speak it with a number of people who still spoke it, very, very few of them. It was mostly the Sassoon-ti monolinguals. They need a while to get adjusted to Western Armenian until they realized we were talking the same language or variations of the same language. As for the rest, the only other dialect I found very different was the one spoken in Vakıf, which is the Musaler dialect. That one is very difficult and I do not speak it or I do not understand it at all, only random words. But as for the rest, no, I spoke mostly Turkish. The conversation was mostly in Turkish. Turkish. I do not speak Kurdish, which is the second language more often spoken by the subject of Steve's book, Kurmanca. But there were also a fair number who spoke Zazaki or Dimli as their mother tongue in a number of regions, in Harpert, in Dersim, and other places. But with them I spoke in Turkish. There were also occasions in which I spoke English. There were a number of people I encountered who were fluent in English. So with them we spoke in English.
Now, the book really does kind of traverse the length and breadth of Turkey. It's mainly based in eastern Anatolia, but of course you spend some time in Istanbul as well, and visiting pretty much every place really where Armenians have historically had a presence. And you describe, you know, literally hundreds of encounters based on various kind of introductions gleaned from one person to the next. And I kind of found myself wondering constantly as I read on throughout the book, how exactly you went about cultivating your kind of extensive contacts? Because a lot of the time it's almost seems like you just kind of rock up at a place and then just leave it to chance. You get chatting to locals and they end up kind of setting you on the path. Could you just talk about this, like how you kind of cultivated this this network of contacts? It's very impressive.
Yeah, well, it was a mixture of things and it took a lot of time to build it. Obviously, I did what you just said. I would just go to a place randomly and look out for Armenians. It didn't always work out well. Most of the time, nothing would happen. At worst, they wouldn't speak and that was it. But the way I built the contacts was basically having one recommending me to another one. That took me a lot of time to build, but there were very, very helpful people along the way who would just put in a good word about me to their connections and would call in people sometimes. So that was very, very kind of the people I interviewed and I saw. It was always fun. And really, my Turkish is not really that great. I became more fluent in it as I was in Turkey. But I initially, especially in the beginnings, I didn't have a lot of rhetorical resources to couch my words with euphemisms or courtesies. So, for example, I was looking for the poshas, which for me is one of the gems in my findings. The poshas are the gypsy Armenians. They are not really ethnically Armenian, but they speak a dialect based on Armenian, a very fascinating group in anthropological sense of the word. I went to a cafe in Istanbul in the Kasımpaşa district, where there is a large concentration of Romas, and I entered into this cafe. I think it's called Muzik or Muzikant. And as soon as I entered, I asked them if there were any gypsy musicians. And they all, you know, roared up with laughter. And they told me, we are all Turks. But they were very helpful as far as they could help. They didn't know any poshas. They hadn't even heard of them. So yeah, that was basically it. It was a combination of things. Facebook as well proved to be a very helpful tool in that regard. Obviously, some would respond, some would not. But it was how I began to build my network of contacts in Turkey.
And the responses, you reference it there, the responses you get as you travel around vary widely, really. Some people are often open and willing to spill the beans, really, about their origins. Others are obviously much more sensitive and defensive. Some people have a very pragmatic perspective, thinking the subject is not, you know, even important at all. Others are more kind of aware of a historical burden. Just talk a bit about the very varied responses that you got. And did they match up, really, with what you were expecting when you started the project?
Well, no, I was surprised, to be honest with you. I was surprised at how openly most people would speak about history, even in places where you could sense they were not very much at ease discussing the very difficult history of Armenians in Turkey. But they would openly talk about the genocide, how their elders survived, and the pressure or the subtle ways of discrimination they faced, not always so subtle. There was still this layer of mistrust between Armenians and Kurds, and mostly Armenians, but sometimes, very honestly, Kurds as well would say it's not as rosy as some purported to be, because now, especially on the Kurdish side, there seems to be a revisionist take on history, as they are becoming more assertive in terms of a nation in Turkey, and they would pretend that they had always been on brotherly terms with Armenians, which is not entirely true. which is not entirely true for all of Turkey. In some places, yes, relations with Armenians and Kurds were mostly good, but in other places, no. In most other places, it was not so. And to be perfectly honest, Kurds and Turks were in a partnership in Ottoman times to rule over the Armenian territories. There were these Kurdish emirates that ruled over the Armenian territories, especially in Sassoon, Muş, and Van, as well as Harpert and Erzurum. So, yes, they would speak up. That would exceed my expectations. What did not match my expectations, and I have to say, underwhelmed, was by how much loss of memory there had been. A lot has been lost, and even people who were willing to speak up and say they were Armenian and who were trying to reassert their Armenian identity would tell me, we just don't know anything. Our elders were very scared that you would encounter that very often. But also, there had been suppression, not only on the part of the genocide survivors in the generations I would mostly interview, which would be third generation Armenians. Very often there were second generation as well, but they would say, in the case of third generation hidden Armenians, they would say even their parents were very reluctant to speak, or they wouldn't speak at all. I was surprised at how little I got in Cilicia and how much fear there was in places like Antap, Adana, Marash, you know, hotbeds of Turkish nationalism. But on the other hand, yes, you found these gems in the Poshas or in Sassoon, where I found still the last remaining Christian Armenians.
One of the things that surprised me as I was reading is that very often, maybe it shouldn't surprise me actually, but a lot of the people who kind of are very open, acknowledge their kind of Armenian heritage, have now become kind of very conservative Muslims and Turkish nationalists in a way. And they kind of, they don't disavow their roots, but they just say very matter-of-factly, you know, that was then, this is now, this is what we are, we've found the true religion, in quotation marks. And, you know, that just shows you how identity is very paradoxical in a way. And people often don't recognize these paradoxes, but when you put them on the page like that, it really is surprising.
Well, it did surprise me as well. That was a shock. That shocked me very much. But then I realized they have been living there for 100 years. As traumatic as the genocide was for us, it must have been horribly traumatic for them as well. I cannot speculate on the mechanisms of adjustment to such an environment after such a traumatic event. I just wonder if this specific case of those who have become devoutly Muslim and proudly Turkish, I'm just wondering if it may have to do with the element of fatalism that you find not only among Armenians, but which is also very present, I believe, in Islamic religion, of accepting God's mysterious will, which is how very often they would describe how they came across Islam. And I'm not paraphrasing here, this was almost verbatim. They would tell me, if this was the way for God to make us discover the true religion, then so be it. Our elders suffered for it, but we have found the truth. I only wonder if that may have to do with the way they have recreated their own identity. But then again, you have to consider, and I know I speak for myself here, but I'm sure I speak for other Armenians as well. Even though it's painful for us to come to terms with that, to come to terms with the fact that the family has remained Armenian, inbreeding basically with other hidden Armenians, they would still consider themselves Turkish and Muslim. Even though it is painful to accept it, you have also to give them some slack and recognize that they have been living on that land for a century now. And it is as fair for them to adjust to their new environment as diaspora Armenians are to their host countries. You have assimilation in the West as well. The fact that it is not hostile or it is not inimical for an Armenian to become French over time, or American, or Argentine, or any other nationality, doesn't disqualify Armenians living in Turkey's East, or what we still call Western Armenia, to adjust to their environment as naturally as they can. Eventually, there's nothing else you can do when everything else has collapsed around you, where there are no institutions left. For example, one reason I found for people converting over time, time was that even though they had remained Christian in the first period after the genocide, well, your relatives die, your father dies, your mother dies, and you have to give them burial. But if there is no church left, there is no Armenian cemetery left, there is no Armenian priest, what kind of burial are you going to give them? So eventually, in a very religious society like the Turkish one is, and this is especially true in the East, you eventually have to conform to what's around you, or you have to move on. Those who wanted to stay Christian in Armenian eventually moved to Istanbul, and from Istanbul elsewhere, you have Armenians moving from Dersim to Istanbul and then to Germany or France, as well as from Van and other places, as well as Diyarbakir. But the others who stayed behind, who mostly stayed behind because of lack of economical resources, well, eventually had to conform and adjust. It's painful to admit, but they had little resource to anything else.
Now, of course, this is obviously a hugely sensitive subject. You spoke to so many people, and obviously there were some quite narrow scrapes that you describe in the book. You describe a couple of times some some rather unpleasant encounters, really, with locals, but also with the authorities and the police, who sometimes kind of track you down as you go about your business. Could you just describe for us here some of the more hairy or dangerous moments that you experienced while on the trail? And also whether from this perspective, whether the project was more straightforward or complicated than you were expecting?
I respond to the second part. I think it was more straightforward than I was expecting. The most difficult part was how I underestimated the scope of work that I had set out for myself. So I thought I would find a more compact group of secret Armenians, and I found it's just basically a definition we give to a very wide group of people who live scattered all over Turkey and who relate to their identity or identities differently. Pretty much, I think it's fair to say, among the hidden Armenians or Islamicized Armenians, you find all the currents you would find in Turkish society, from extreme nationalism to the ultra-left. The hairiest encounter was by far the one I had in Ardala. Ardala is a village in the Black Sea, in the province of Artvin, near Hopa. That's where the biggest cluster of Hamshen villages are. And Ardala is known among the Hamshenses as a hotbed of Turkish nationalism. And I got myself into trouble for not listening to what my Hamshensi friends were telling me of not going to Ardala. But I insisted, because I knew, and Hamshensi themselves would recognize it, that the best spoken Homshetsnak, which is now qualified as a definitely endangered language by UNESCO. So I went to Ardala to check out the language, to record songs and verses in Homshetsnak, as well as conversations. And I was fooled into walking deeper into the village, because the village is divided between the upper town and the lower town, or the upper quarter and lower quarter. And the lower quarter residents are a family who are known for their pro-Armenian views and who have a very friendly disposition towards Armenians. So as I encountered this friendly welcome in them, I was fooled into walking further up, where they were becoming less and less friendly. And I was surrounded by them. I tried to run away from a guy that had become threatening. And I had this gut feeling in my stomach that something was wrong. And I finally decided that my gut was right, and I ran away from this young man who, strangely enough, looked like me. I mean, we could pass for distant cousins, maybe. And we initially were speaking in Homshetsnak, and he told me to go away because it was likely that they would beat me up in their village. So I took his warning as a friendly or unfriendly advice, and I left. But then he told me to stop. A pickup truck was coming up, and I saw the driver peering from behind the windshield at me, and I realized that he was looking at me with suspicion. You have to bear in mind that Hopa and these towns are small, and the word spreads that there is an Armenian in town, and he probably had seen me in Hopa, and he told the other young man to stop me. So I complied for a while. He passed on a mobile phone, on the other side of which someone was hurling insults and curses at me, and telling bad things about me and my Armenian ancestry. And then I ran, but then I was cut off by a car in which this young man was, and other men joined them, and they surrounded me, and they hung a Turkish flag before me, and they thankfully called the gendarme other countryside police. I say thankfully because I felt that they could become physically violent, that they could beat me up because I was resisting to have my photo taken with the Turkish flag in a kind of hostage situation. It was a parody, obviously, but it was very frightening. I was on a mountain village far from everyone, and I had idiotically carried all my notebooks and memory chips with me, so I was very scared that they would be confiscated by the police. And that was scary. They brought me to the gendarme headquarters in Hopa. They finally let me go, and they told me to get a permit or an izin from the kaymakam office in Hopa. I went to the kaymakam's office, and as I was leaving, the same sergeant who had detained me in Ardala came running almost breathless, and he told me to accompany him again, that there was a little thing to sort out, and then I knew that things were going badly. And they were discussing about turning me over to the police. The gendarme is a rural police, and they are mostly, or at least with me, they were mostly friendly, whereas the police have a different reputation in Turkey. And I was now becoming worried, because I had overheard them discussing sending me to the MIT headquarters in Ankara. The MIT is the intelligence police. So that was the scariest thing that happened to me. And there were a couple of other scary incidents, but they were much less so compared to what happened to in Ardala. Ardala was really scary, but it was a lesson for me. First of all, you have to trust what the locals say. When they advise you probably not to go to a certain place, you have to listen to them. And the second thing I learned in Turkey was, even though a visa nominally allows you to circulate freely in Turkey, by custom, villages are really out of bounds, off limits for a visitor, unless you have someone you are visiting in the village. Custom in Turkey, I learned, dictates that you need to have an invitation from a local, or at least request permission from the muhtar, which is what I did afterwards. And everything went smoothly. Obviously, I didn't go back to nationalist outposts, but if you follow local custom, you usually should be out of trouble. But you do need to make sure that the place you're going is not hostile towards Armenians. It can become, if not dangerous, they can give you trouble.
I suppose it's also important to mention that you were traveling at a time of kind of relative calm, actually, in the region. Some of it was when the peace process between the state and the PKK, the Kurdish militants, was still ongoing, before that broke down and before, you know, large parts of eastern Anatolia kind of descended back into violence and became effectively no-go zones. So in a way, perhaps your timing was kind of fortunate in that sense.
It was absolutely fortunate, and that's the thing. And that's the thing that you can only assess in hindsight. As I was writing the book, I was the impression that I was writing a dated book, because eventually these Armenians would be coming out of hiding, so to speak, within a matter of years or a decade or so. So I was in a big hurry to finish the book before they came out and stopped being secret Armenians. As it happened, Turkey reverted to more, I wouldn't say repressive, things have become more restrictive in Turkey these days, and I'm sure I would have much more difficulty in talking or traveling as freely and openly as I did back in the day. So yes, that was fortunate, but at the time I thought, well, there is no turning back here. Whereas in the villages, the older people, pour la galerie, would pretend, yes, everything is fine, we are free now, and Turkey is a marvelous country. But when I switched off my recorder, they would tell me, my son, this is still Turkey. Don't be fooled by what you're seeing in Istanbul.
Now, well, we referenced it a bit earlier, but one of the most kind of unique passages comes at the end of the book, when you go to the Eastern Black Sea region in the mountains above Rize. And this is a very evocative, remote and really kind of breathtaking landscape. And it's a place where this small, rather scattered community of a few thousand people called the Hemşenses still live. In Turkish, they're known as Hemşimli. Now, in this community are today Muslims who converted to Islam from the Armenian Apostolic Church centuries ago, I think in the 16th century, but they still speak, or some of them still speak, this endangered and very rare dialect of Armenian. And these are very fascinating sections of the book, so please do just kind of expand a bit on the Hemşenlis and your time up there in those mountains.
Well, yes, I loved being in Hamshen, and I bonded very strongly with them, mainly because of the very archaic and old dialect they speak. It's incredible how powerful a link language is for us Armenians, even though many Hamshensis, perhaps most, would be reluctant to describe themselves as Armenian. They would not, or some would not describe themselves as Armenian at all. It was very moving because it really felt like time travel when I first spoke with them in their strange dialect, very old, which to me sounded a bit like the classical Armenian you hear during Mass in an Armenian church, because obviously their dialect is rooted still in the 8th century dialect they spoke when they first moved from Oshagan in the Vaspuragan region of Armenia. That's where now the Republic of Armenia is. And they moved to the Pontic region in the 8th century following an uprising against the Arab rulers. And it was poignant because you could see the language disappearing in the younger generations. But the most poignant part of it was that they spoke Armenian, an Armenian that I, or for that matter, any other Western Armenian could recognize. Even if you don't speak Hamshetsnak, you can pick up some Armenian words and you can realize this is a dialect of Armenian. And it was poignant because you could see how much of a gap had opened over the centuries. And some of them, obviously, especially in Western Hamshen or Hemshin, have renounced the language a long time ago. They only speak some words, isolated words they have in their dialect of Turkish. And you sense that the more open-minded among them are trying to reconnect with their past, but that those bridges have burned a long time ago. Those bridges being the language, but also the religious affiliation. It's perfectly normal for an Armenian to be an atheist, but for some reason belong to the larger Armenian community. Whereas the Hamshensis, many of whom are already atheists and Marxists, and that's a reason for a lot of speculation as to the reasons of why so many Hamshensis are so inclined to be on the extreme left of Turkish politics, to be Marxist-Leninists of the hardcore sort, who don't go to mosques, who don't observe Ramadan, who are atheists. Some see it as a sign of still repulsion against forced conversion. I'm not sure about that, but it's an interesting feature of them that they still resist being in the mainstream, that they stick to their particularities. Some Hamshensis now travel a lot to Armenia. They are delighted to discover that they have a common ancestry with Armenians. These are things that came to light only after the internet. Before the internet, these regions, as you say, were very remote. The object of urban myths, for example, an urban myth about the Hamshensis was that an Armenian militant called Levon Ekmekjian, he was a member of Asala. Asala was an organization that carried out terrorist attacks in Turkey and Europe in the 70s and 80s. Levon Ekmekjian, who carried out a terrorist attack at the airport of Esenboğa in Turkey in 1985, I believe, according to a myth, had spoken in Armenian on Turkish TV at his trial, in which he was summarily condemned to execution. He was executed the following day. And this is apparently a myth. I've been trying to browse video records of this alleged Armenian statement on Turkish TV by Levon Ekmekjian, and I've come up with nothing. There is a short clip in which he speaks in Turkish. He requests permission to speak his mind in Turkish to a Turkish judge, who allows him to speak, but I didn't find anything in Armenian. And yet there is this enduring myth that he had spoken in Armenian, and that it had been the first time the Hamshensis, many of whom didn't know anything about their Armenian origin, they had realized upon hearing this alleged Armenian statement by Levon Ekmekjian that they spoke the same language, and that the rumors that they had heard that they were of Armenian origin were indeed true. And yet every Hamshensi that, according to a friend, had claimed that he had heard Levon Ekmekjian say these words refused to speak on the record for me about this. Because I would tell them, have you really heard Levon Ekmekjian speaking in Armenian, and that being the first time you realized that your language was Armenian? And they would refuse to speak. But there was this interesting anecdote of Hamshensis. Hamshensis have a lot of joie de vivre. They enjoy life very much. They like drinking and feasting. And there was this guy, I think he was called Mahmoud or Mehmet, who had been drinking drinking at a bar in Hopa, listening to Levon Ekmekçian making a statement to Turkish courts. And he'll raise his glass to a toast to Levon Ekmekçian, saying in Homshetsnak, this is my cousin, or I raise my glass to my cousin. And he had been arrested the following day, or he had been brought to the police station the following day, with the police officers asking him about his cousin. And, you know, he had drank a lot and he didn't remember anything. And he was saying, which cousin? And they were saying, the one who was on TV. He was wondering why his cousins would be on TV. They were all farmers, I mean, common people. And he was naming them, Zia, Ahmed, Mahmoud, Ali, Riza. No, they were saying, the other. And they finally slapped him and they gave him a beating for a week. And they told him, it's Levon Ekmekçian. And they sent him back home. But Mahmoud or Mehmet died in a car accident 2 years ago, so I couldn't corroborate on the veracity of this anecdote. And his son didn't know anything about this, and he believed his father had been arrested for his leftist views, but he didn't know anything about this anecdote.
At the core of the book is this central question of what you call kind of protean identity, and this idea of like kaleidoscopic impermanence and complications. And there are all kinds of gradients of identity that you describe in the book. Obviously, there are the ethnic and religious labels on the surface, but there are also kind of local and tribal and linguistic layers that really do give this impression of a very bewildering kind of kaleidoscope. It kind of made me wonder in an almost psychological way how this interacts really with the constant and very real present of kind of fanaticism and nationalism and religious fundamentalism that you also reference in the book. You know, perhaps the kind of volatile temperaments that you describe are kind of triggered by that almost paranoid search for something firm and rigid, you know, in contrast with the reality, which is very murky indeed.
Well, yes, I very often found that these outward symbols of nationalism and religion were kind of a shield to protect your hidden or true or intimate or private identity. And it was very often that I would find emblems of Turkish nationalism in the house of the people I visited. I guess it's normal in Turkey, but it was also, I guess it afforded them a layer of protection. Yes, identity, I believe I've come to believe is a very elastic definition. Over time, we acquire or shed identities. That has been my case. And not only because of my own decisions. I was born an Armenian in Aleppo. I was raised in Argentina. And none of these three choices was mine. And yet I cannot claim I have a Syrian identity. I was too small. But on my passport, it says that I was born in Aleppo, Syria. So it is part of my identity as well, if only legally. But I am Syrian in a sense. And then I went to America and I became an American. And I'm now living in Italy. I cannot claim I'm an Italian, but over time I may become one. So identity changes over time. And the particular circumstances of Turkey that make it so difficult to have these identities coexist is still Atatürk's attempt to cast the Turkish state as a nation state, whereas it has remained, in fact, a rump of the Ottoman Empire with different minorities coexisting in it. I was astonished to see people whom I assumed to be Turks describing themselves as Macedonians, even though they were fourth or fifth generation Macedonians or Albanians. Yes, they would say, we are Turks, but we are also Macedonian, or we are Albanian. So it's a multi-ethnic empire still. If we take a very basic definition of empire being an extension of land conquered by a group of people and ruling over other nations, well, then Turkey still fits that definition. So in the sense, it has remained an empire. It's not fashionable, and it's not what the constitution says about Turkey. And I'm sure it wasn't the project of Atatürk. Atatürk was clearly trying to convert Turkey into nation state. You can say up to a point he succeeded, but up to a different point he failed too. And you can see maybe a reflection of that in the current neo-Ottoman fashions and the tendencies you see in the Erdogan regime, which, if you ask me, I wouldn't say it's more benign for Armenians, at least. But Turkey hasn't still become a nation state. In many senses, yes, it has, but it's still, I'm not sure how much of a melting pot, but it is a mosaic of different ethnicities and nationalities, much subdued, much assimilated, but still living separate lives and still not taking part in power. I remember this Sassoon Armenian kid, and he's the son of a Christian Armenian family in Sassoon, one of the four Armenian Christian families left. When I asked him what he wanted to become when he grew up, he told me a policeman, which shocked me. But then I realized, of course, he lives in Turkey. And then I was told there was something in the psychology of kids. This had been informally studied by a Kurdish friend I have in Diyarbakir. She was shocked too, as a teacher, to see that many Kurdish kids would want to become soldiers or policemen in Turkey when they grew up. And this was happening in the years of the Kurdish uprising. So digging deeper, she found out these kids wanted to become soldiers or policemen to protect their families. And so this kid, when his father in my presence told me, no, you cannot become a policeman because you are Armenian. Armenians cannot become policemen. This is an unwritten rule in Turkey. You don't have Christian minorities becoming policemen or soldiers or officers or holding positions of power in the government. And then the kid said, well, then I would like to become a pilot. He meant in the Turkish Air Force, which was a no-no as well. And then he wanted to be a commercial airline pilot. And he said, well, you can't for Turkish Airlines, his father said. Maybe he was wrong here, but that's the atmosphere in which they live because you are Armenian and Armenians cannot work for state companies. So in that restrictive environment, I don't know how much of a Turkish nation state you can build. Well, certainly you cannot build an inclusive one, which is the present situation in Turkey. Turkey is not an inclusive nation state. It's, as Atatürk said, Turkey for the Turks. And it still is.
That was Avadis Hajian. Many thanks to him. Remember to consider signing up as a Turkey Book Talk member. And don't forget that that membership system now includes the sizable archive of 231 reviews that I wrote over 5 years until this past summer for the Hürriyet Daily News. The reviews cover subjects ranging from Turkish and international fiction and poetry to history, journalism, politics, the Middle East and Europe. And because they no longer exist online, from now on a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. Members also get access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every interview as it's published via email, as well as transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 70 conversations so far. And members are also able to get a hefty 30% discount on a catalogue of over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening. Bütün dünyayı gezdim dolaştım, anladım ki sen...